Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And I would like to introduce Ted Flicker. He's an actor, writer, director, filmmaker, sculptor, artist, man of many, many venues of creativity. And his film, his 1967 film, is The President's Analyst. Welcome, Ted Flicker.
Thank you.
We just heard the opening few bars of the music of the film, The President's Analyst. I have to say, this is a great occasion for me personally because this has been, for many years, one of my favorite films. It's a cult classic. A lot of people probably in our audience haven't heard of it. Those in the know have heard of it and seen it. It's an amazing film, a political satire, and we're going to talk about it in a few minutes. But I thought we could start by just talking about you and your life. You were a trained actor from an early age?
Yeah. I graduated from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London and thought I would grow up to be Laurence Olivier. I'm astonished that I didn't.
A New Jersey boy, yeah. Going to London. How did you manage that? Were you always acting as a child?
From the moment I played Jiminy Cricket in third grade, and they started to applaud, I got it. I knew what I wanted in my life.
Isn't that funny? Was it the applause or was it the actual craft and experience of doing the acting?
In third grade? Had to be the applause.
It was the applause.
Right.
But then you developed and you were doing classical theater.
Yep.
And then that evolved into comedy, not too slowly.
Yeah. I guess that's who I was. It came automatically, naturally. I loved making audiences laugh. When I think about it, I think probably there's an element of control there that was appealing to the younger, more aggressive me.
That's very interesting. You control an audience by making them laugh?
Yeah.
How's that work?
Well, they're sitting there quietly, and you do something, and they all laugh. And they laugh because you decided they're going to laugh at that moment.
I've actually had that experience during uncomfortable political conversations at the dinner table. You make a joke and everything changes and you sort of control the experience.
Of course. And that, of course, developed into political satire, which came out of my rage at the way the world was.
So this was the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Started in the mid-50s.
What were the political events and circumstances that enraged you at that time?
Almost everything. I was shattered that Adlai Stevenson lost to Eisenhower. I was horrified by the grayness of the 50s. Fortunately for me, I hung out with a lot of beats. As a matter of fact, ultimately I wrote a Broadway musical about the beat generation called The Nervous Set.
Which does seem a little bit like a, I don't know, oxymoron exactly, but a Broadway musical about the beatniks?
Yeah, it was, I knew so many of them. There was such intensity that it needed to be needled a little bit. And it also needed to be explained to the world. Had it not been a flop, I might have explained it to more of the world.
Does that, when you write a musical like that and then it's performed somewhere, what happens to it? It's just in a, did it ever get taped, or is it in a box somewhere?
No, it doesn't.
Has anyone ever done it since
then? They did a 50-year revival of it in St. Louis. I hear it was even worse than the original production. But I did it first in my theater in St. Louis, where it was a huge success. But it's a huge success in St. Louis. And when we got to New York, I wasn't really ready for Broadway, and I made some huge mistakes. There was a song in the second act, for instance, called Pitch for Pot. That was really a marvelous song. The best thing about the show was the score and the lyrics.
Did you write them?
No, Tommy Wolfe wrote the music, a great jazz artist, and Fran Landesman wrote the lyrics, and she's still writing lyrics. She's probably 80 now, and she's still performing them in England.
So this song didn't go over well in New York?
No, the producers convinced me that it would offend Walter Kerr, the critic for the Herald Tribune, and I had to take it out.
Oh, no.
And like an idiot, I said, okay. And they also talked me into recasting the show for New York, and that was a disaster. I made all these dumb mistakes because I thought they knew and I didn't. After all, this was Broadway. The producer was this elegant man who really knew theater and was quite well known. And the biggest financier was Goddard Lieberson, who was the president of Columbia Records. And the last show he financed was My Fair Lady. And when they told me stuff, I said, well, this is Broadway and they know.
And here you are, some 20-something young man.
Yeah. And that distorted my whole career, because when I realized what I'd done after the collapse of the show, I knew it was my fault. And I thereafter became impossible to deal with for studio executives and network executives.
Because you knew what you wanted and you weren't going to ever compromise again?
Right. I knew if they suggested anything, it was wrong.
Just out of hand.
Out of hand. And as a matter of fact, 99.9% of the time, they were wrong. I just wasn't wonderful about the way I explained to them how wrong they were.
We're talking to Ted Flicker. So you did a musical comedy about the Beat Poets. You did a bunch of improvisational theater in Chicago. Tell us about your work there and your theater companies there.
Well, I decided that what New York really needed was a popular show, a theater dedicated to doing great plays with a $3.50 top for orchestra seats. At that time on Broadway, orchestra seats for Broadway shows were $8.50. And we would sit around and say, you know, two tickets for a Broadway show and parking your car and dinner could add up to $50, and nobody can afford that. I mean, that's only for the elite.
What's that the equivalent of today, $250 or something?
Well, Mel Brooks's show is opening with orchestra seats at $450.
Good heavens.
But those are for select best seats and can be ordered almost immediately.
So you were doing something that kept the prices down for the audience.
I was hoping to create this theater, and I went out and actually raised money for it. And the only thing I needed to do was to get the craft unions, the stagehands, to agree not to featherbed. That let me just hire the people I actually need to move the scenery and run the lights. And I went to their council and I presented this whole plan, and they laughed me out of the room. And so it failed. The only thing I have left from that's wonderful is I have a correspondence with William Saroyan, where he explains to me why his play Fat Man in a Famine is better than Macbeth. That's at USC, the USC Library, with my other papers.
So it didn't work out because of...
It just didn't work out because of the craft unions. But there I was, I had 30 grand, promised. And in those days, you could start a theater with that. And then I got a call from my old pal, Severin Darden.
Who is in this movie, The President's Analyst.
Right. And he was working in Chicago at a thing called the Compass Theater, which was the first real improvisational theater in our modern era. And it sounded fascinating. He sent his producer to me, who was kind of a saint and an impossible businessman. And I said, okay, I'll come out and see what it's like, and if it works for me, we'll use my 30 grand to bring it to New York. And I went out and was immediately hooked. The company at that time was Severin, Mike Nichols, Elaine May, Shelley Berman, Barbara Harris, and we're all kids. And we all knew we were funnier than Sid Caesar. And I worked with the company, and then we got an offer.
Now, these were the early days of comedy improv, I take it.
The beginning. All the rest followed us.
So there was comedy, but it was scripted before.
Oh, yeah. But we were the first improvisational theater in the country, probably in the world since the Weimar Republic.
Good heavens.
In Germany, they had something called the living newspaper in some of the clubs, where people called out headlines and they improvised sketches.
We're talking to Ted Flicker.
So we then got an offer to open it in a saloon in St. Louis. And the director at that time said, oh, no, I'm not going. I said, you go to St. Louis. I'll go to New York and get our theater open there, and we'll switch companies. Keep it fresh. He said, oh, no, you're just trying to lose me in the provinces somewhere. He's right. And we later became the best of friends. As a matter of fact, his portrait was the very first portrait I did when I started sculpting. I went to St. Louis, and we opened, and we were a huge success. And I asked Mike and Elaine to come out, and Severin, of course. And Elaine and I met. We knew there was something wrong. We knew that we were funny and we were doing it, but it was messy. And we knew that it needed order, rules, how to improvise in public. And Elaine and I met. We were all in the same rooming house. Elaine and I met every morning for breakfast, and we devised the rules, which still obtain today.
Isn't that interesting? What are just for our audience? What are a couple of those rules?
Oh God! One of them is that on stage, since we have no props, everything is pantomime. That means we can have all props. But if an actor comes on stage, Severin once came on stage, and he played a very gentle character, and he came on stage holding an imaginary rabbit in his hands. And Shelley Berman made fun of him, siding with the audience, making a fool out of Severin. That's denying the reality that Severin brought on stage. I fired.
So that's against the rules.
Against the rules. Elaine and I decided you can never deny the reality another actor brings. If an actor says, how do you like my elephant? There's an elephant on stage.
And so that made it less messy to do things like that.
Oh, of course. things like you can never do business on stage. You can't get into a negotiation to buy or sell something. Boring. And another was that the actors on stage were not allowed to end the scene. That was the obligation of the actors off stage who had the light board. So that if they heard what they thought was a great punchline, blackout.
Very interesting.
Or if they saw a scene running toward the sentimental, they would slowly start dimming the lights and the actors on stage would know where they're going.
We're talking to Ted Flicker. So you did improvisational theater. You really did more theater than film until you went to Hollywood. What is that right? No, you made a film called The Troublemaker.
Yeah.
Was that in Hollywood?
No, I made that in New York. I had the only two really big flops in my theater career were both musicals. And this one was called I Want You, and it was about war profiteering in the sheet music business of World War I. It was a silly show, and I loved it. Broke my heart when I had to close it. But I had to close it after four performances. Richard Watts, the critic for the New York Post, who had always written wonderful reviews of my work, said, for committing this crime on the New York theater-going audience, Theodore J. Flicker should be stood up on the Jersey Palisades and shot.
Oh, heavens.
That's my favorite bad review.
I don't think they're even allowed to say stuff like that anymore.
And I thought, well, the hell with this. I'm not going to work 2 years on a show and have it close in four performances and totally disappear. I'm going to make a movie. At least with a movie, if it's a flop, you can take it home and show it to your mother.
Right.
So Buck Henry and I went out to Palm Springs and wrote a script called The Troublemaker, a comedy based on what happened to me when I opened my coffee house improvisational theater, The Premise, and refused to pay off. And those days in New York, you didn't do anything without paying off the cops, the health inspector, the liquor license people, the fire department. And I said, no way.
In real life you did, or in the movie you did?
In real life.
Really?
And we were in a lot of trouble for quite a while. We decided to write a comedy about it. And we wrote The Troublemaker, which was about an innocent who refuses to pay off. And it was funny. It played at the Venice. We were too late to get into competition at the Venice Film Festival that year. But we got such reviews out of competition. I told you my worst review. My favorite review came from a French critic at the Venice Film Festival. He said The Troublemaker was a combination of Voltaire, Brecht, and the Marx Brothers.
Where is this film? Why haven't we seen it?
I don't know.
Well, that remains to be discussed.
Belongs to Janus Films. They financed it. It never got a bad review. I look at it and I see every mistake I made. Stanley Kubrick and I were friends then, and I said, Stanley, I'm overwhelmed by all this junk around me. I got a whole crew standing watching me work, and I don't know the focal length of a lens, and I can't take a Nagra apart blindfolded. And he said, Ted, just treat it like a dictaphone. Just tell it what you want.
A dictaphone, for our younger listeners, ladies and gentlemen, is a secretarial device of the old days.
Right. And I forget, we made the picture for Peanuts. And I look at it and I see every mistake I made, and I made a lot of them.
And did you bring that to your next film, the lessons that you learned from it?
Oh, of course. When I got out to Hollywood, I realized that I knew very little about filmmaking. And so I decided I would direct a bunch of television and learn about the camera. And I'd come on to a show and I'd say to the cameraman, look, I don't know about this stuff. I'm going to need your help. And they were all wonderful. They would show me about lenses. And
so you made a big move from New York to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
What possessed you to do that?
One day, I was walking down 55th Street, and when I got to the corner of 6th Avenue, somebody shoved me off the sidewalk, and they started digging a new subway. And I thought, I don't want to live here. And I had already made The Troublemaker. And I thought, I'm going to Hollywood and make pictures.
So that was the mid-60s, early mid-60s?
That was 1964. And I brought the premise out to Hollywood, my improvisational theater, so that I would have a running start. And everybody came, and everybody knew me, and I got all kinds of interesting offers. And I went with, there were three guys in Hollywood. Over a 30-year period, these are the only three guys who never attempted to cheat me or go back on a contract. Sheldon Leonard, who produced Andy Griffith and Dick Van Dyke, a prince of a man, and Bob Aldridge, who produced, who directed Dirty Dozen, and George Lucas, who's George Lucas. Outside of that, in 30 years, it was lawsuits and fighting and not a lot of fun.
So how did you start making this 1967 film, The President's Analyst? You were the writer, director, and based on your past experience of giving up control, you really controlled every single aspect of that film.
Right.
What was the inspiration?
I had opened a premise in Washington, D.C. in the Shoreham Hotel. And at that time in the early 60s, they treated us like diplomats from an uncommitted nation. And we had great fun doing political satire in Washington, and they all came. It was the Kennedy administration. And I was invited to a dinner by the guy who owned the hotel. And everybody at the dinner was somebody I recognized. There was Senator Fulbright and Magnuson, and except the guy next to me was bald and skinny and sweating and nervous. And I didn't catch his name or remember it, and I didn't know who he was. And after dinner, I asked Bernie, our host, who is that guy? And Bernie said, oh, he's a psychiatrist, and he has the highest possible clearance because he is who they call when a CIA guy or a five-star general starts to go over the edge. And it stuck in my head, and years later in Hollywood, I was looking for a subject, and there it was.
And so you made this film starring James Coburn, who plays the role of the psychoanalyst of the President of the United States, who is recruited into this role, not even knowing that it's going to come his way. And hilarity ensues from there, because, of course, everybody in the whole entire world wants the secrets that only he knows.
Right. And it became a kind of funny chase picture. And it is damn good. I had great problems at the studio as a result of my Broadway experience. The head of the studio was an idiot named Bob Evans.
And that attitude really helped your working relationship.
Immediately. But I knew the first meeting that I was talking to a moron. And he had his sidekick, who was his intellectual watchdog, is now editor-in-chief of Variety, Peter Bart, who's a phony intellectual. And the very first meeting talking about the script, which they said they loved.
So you spent 6 months writing the script.
Yeah.
They decided to make it. They said they loved it.
Yeah. I gave them, when they read it, I gave them 1 week to decide, which is unheard of. The whole thing happened like that. The way it got made was Jim was doing the Flint pictures, and he was a big star.
And James Coburn.
Coburn, yeah. And I was at an A-list party. Those were my days on the A-list, brief as they were. And Jimmy and I knew each other from Paris, where he was shooting Charade, which my pal had written. And I went over to Paris to watch a movie being made, which I had never seen. And I became pals with all those actors in the show. Jimmy came over to me and said, "Hey, man, you got anything?" And I said, "Yeah, I just finished a great script." And he said, "Well, let me read it." I said, "I'll get it over to you tomorrow." Unheard of that he would read it that day. 5 o'clock, my phone rings. It's him. He says, "I love it. Let's do it." Unheard of that a star would answer that fast. Today, you can wait a year for an answer. And I went over to his house, and his agent was there. And the agent said, "Well, these two guys are now going to run Paramount. Let's get it right to them." I said, "Okay, tell them they got 1 week." And they went for it. And we went immediately into preparation. And I hired bunch of my improvisational actors, Severin Darden, Godfrey Cambridge, who played the Russian spy, Joan Darling, who played the housewife who did the karate. And it was, except for my war with the... let me tell you how Bob Evans got to be the head of the studio. It's a Hollywood story. The story told around Hollywood was that he was on a plane, and seated next to him was Charlie Bluthorn. These were the days before everybody had a private jet. And Charlie complained to Bob, who was a New York playboy. His total show business career had been as a bullfighter in some picture where he was... where his performance was less than wonderful. And Charlie complained to him that he couldn't get a table at Danny's Hideaway, an East Side steakhouse where a lot of beautiful hookers hang out in those days. And as soon as they got on the ground, Bob called Danny's Hideaway and arranged for Charlie to get a table and to meet girls. So Charlie gave him the studio.
We're talking to Ted Flicker. And so basically, I mean, the short version of that is the gap between management and creativity was a rather wide gap.
Huge.
And so you had to deal within this, but there you were making this film, The President's Analyst, and you got to do everything the way you wanted it. The cinematography, you were working with the editor from the very first day of shooting,
right,
and then long into post-production, the music.
Mm-hmm. Lalo Schifrin. As a matter of fact, I wrote the lyrics for one of the songs.
Lalo Schifrin, a very well-known composer, including movie score composer.
It was all my way because I had to really fight every time they came up with a stupid suggestion, which was fairly often. I had to find a way of blocking it and going on with the real work, which I did. But if I had understood how to be political, if I had understood how to flatter them while I was not doing what they wanted, I might have had a career after the President's Analyst crashed.
There, even the story of the editing is fascinating to me. You edited the film with this brilliant editor just the way you wanted
it. Stuart Pape, who lived here in Santa Fe for 20 years.
And the studio re-edited it against your wishes.
Well, because of our wonderful relationship, the minute I finished the required director's cut that they had to give me, they had security escort me off the lot, and they then became important filmmakers and began cutting up my picture and screwing around with it. And Stuart, God bless him, every time they would make a change, he would take the original of what they changed and give it a different number and hide it in a box. And the night before the picture was to be shipped to negative cutting, he and I sneaked in the studio and we put the picture back to my cut.
At like 2 in the morning or something?
All night. All night. It was daylight when we left. And we shipped it.
So what got shipped and printed and distributed was, in fact, the director's cut.
Right.
So then this film opened in 1967, the same week as The Graduate came out.
Yeah.
Got rave reviews.
It got fantastic reviews, and we were doing the same business as The Graduate. I was in Rome at the time, writing my next picture, which I never made. And I began getting cables from the studio. We have a monster hit. Congratulations, etc., etc., etc. And then I get a phone call, and it's Charlie Bluthorn, who was a man with a well-known foul mouth. And he said, "What the explicative deleted have you done to me?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I'm pulling your explicative deleted picture out of the theaters." And I started to hyperventilate. I said, "Charlie, what are you talking about? We have a major hit." He said, "What the explicative deleted do I care about your major hit?" I got a call from the White House asking how I could do a picture like that. And I own 27 companies, do business in Washington. And it's done. I'm pulling the picture. And he pulled it.
So who in the White House was angry about it?
Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover called the White House, and the White House, somebody at the White House, just passed it along to Charlie. And I knew when I was writing the script that the one thing that made Hoover absolutely nuts was how short he was. As a matter of fact, every graduating class of the FBI Academy had to go into his office and shake his hand. There were two things. He would check how they were dressed, cuffs on the pants, button-down shirt. There were two things. If their hands sweat, or if they looked down to see the box that Hoover was standing on, they didn't graduate.
Oh, my goodness.
And
so here you have this tiny, short actor, Walter Burke,
right,
playing the satirical depiction of J. Edgar Hoover, essentially.
I cast all the FBI guys around 5 foot. Walter Burke was just under 5 feet. And I did a scene where I had a room full of really short guys, and I hired a kid who was 6'6" to be a secretary and walk all the way through the room.
Which is a very funny scene.
Which apparently drove Hoover nuts.
And so suddenly you had this smash hit of a movie that was toast.
Toast. Disappeared. And now my behavior in the making of the picture caught up with me.
Came back to haunt you.
If
you'd been political and,
right.
and kissed their whatever, you would
right.
have probably not had this happen.
But, you know, if you have a hit, you can behave badly. Roman Polanski was making, just after The President's Analyst, he was making Rosemary's Baby on the same lot. And the producer was a guy I knew and liked, Bill Castle, who had only made B pictures in his life, horror pictures. And he came over to me and he said, "Ted, I got to ask you a question. You're of this younger generation. I was having a meeting with Roman and I said something and he got up and went out the window. What do you think that means?" I said, "It means he doesn't agree with you, Bill." But Rosemary's Baby was a hit.
So he could do whatever he wanted.
Whatever.
And if this studio person hadn't had companies that were doing business in Washington, the outcome still would have been different.
Yeah.
The President's Analyst is a film that was made at this incredibly aesthetically rich moment in American cultural history, and your movie is kind of a time capsule that has a lot of that mid-late 60s feeling in it, including the music. I thought we could play just little bits of some of the music in it. There's a piece which is the music that is in the background when James Coburn realizes that he is going to be the psychoanalyst of the President of the United States.
Oh, that's the one I wrote the lyrics for.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Let's hear it. That's just a little bit of the feeling of this movie, The President's Analyst. You also worked with Barry Maguire.
Oh, I loved Barry. Barry was the ultimate hippie. He was such a sweet man. Hard to believe he wrote The Eve of Destruction. He was wonderful in the picture.
So he was a real hippie rock and roller?
A real hippie. I mean, he, at the first big love-in in Los Angeles, in Griffith Park, he got naked with a girl and they made love. A first time in the 60s anybody ever saw that kind of sexual liberation.
And there he was in this movie, and it's actually a great moment of the movie where James Coburn, as the analyst, is trying to escape from all these people who are chasing him, and he ends up in a love bus with Barry Maguire. I also wanted to play just a little bit of that music, too.
There was a time she needed me to leave. There was a time, but now it's past and gone.
Blue ice cubes? How degenerate.
I'll be proud to see what she's come to be. She's ready to be free. If you're trying to see, she's through needing me. Even though I cry myself to sleep at night, I can't help knowing what was done was right. I hope she knows I'll always be around. If ever that doesn't ask, never hits the ground.
So what happened to this film after it was pulled, after a week and a half, monster hit, 1967, suddenly it's gone? What happened next? What was the life cycle of the film?
It was over. It was sequestered. After Hoover died, they sold it to television, and they sold it as a three-hour show, and it was only an hour and a half. And in order to make it fill 3 hours, they put all my outtakes in it.
Oh, heavens.
So it made no sense. I didn't see my cut again until I saw it. It was the film that opened the Taos Film Festival. And I went, and it's the first time I saw it.
And when was that?
I don't know, whenever it opened, some years
ago. In the 90s.
Yeah. And Jimmy Coburn came up for it, and we had a nice reunion.
But it's become a cult classic. I mean, I became aware of this film in the 80s, and I borrowed somebody else's VCR so I could make a dub of it with two VCRs and kept this tape, which is worn out because I've showed it to so many of my friends. I can't be the only one. There must be people. I mean, do you hear from them?
I do. It's odd. I periodically get a fan letter. But mostly, I run into people like you. Somebody will say, Ted Flicker? The president's analyst?
I believe I might have done that when I first met you.
You did. And it's nice. It's good.
So you went into making television after that, and then you decided...
I fell off. I was kicked off the A-list. And suddenly, I was also broke. I had to make a living. And the one place where I was acceptable was in television, because they saw me as a big-time film writer and director. But I had to write shows like The Mod Squad. And there you follow the rules.
Yeah.
If on page 23 there's a car crash, in your script on page 23 you got a car crash. I recall falling asleep at my typewriter writing those things.
And you wrote for the Dick Van Dyke Show.
No, I directed the Dick Van Dyke Show. And that was fun. And I directed the Andy Griffith Show. That was fun. Andy, one day we were shooting, and they finished the shot, and Andy started telling the actress who played his girlfriend how to correct her performance. And I took him aside, and I said, Andy, when you do that, it means your focus while you're doing your performance is not 100% on you where it should be. Now, I'm the director. Trust me. If something is wrong, I'll fix it. And we did another scene, and when it was over, I said to her what she needed to do to make the scene work. And Andy said, damn, you do know what you're doing. And we became good friends.
Now, you got then out of TV, film, theater, the whole thing, and went into the most apparent, seemingly unlikely direction, which is you went into doing sculpture, which is so solitary compared to everything you were doing before.
It's wonderful. What I did before, from the very beginning,
from Jiminy Cricket.
From Jiminy Cricket is collaborative art. You can't do theater by yourself. You can't make a film by yourself. And even if I were the financier of the picture, and the producer, and the writer, and the director, and the editor, it would still be collaborative, because you have to collaborate with the actors. And if I learned anything from the improvisational theater, which is the most collaborative, it's that if an actor had a problem playing a scene I wrote, the fault generally was not the actor's, but mine, that somehow I'd screwed up the inner logic. And we'd then work it out together. It gave me a reputation of being an actor's director, which I liked. I was never a fancy technical director.
And so then, but then you got out of the collaborative thing altogether.
Yeah. In 1979, I'd had a hit television series, Barney Miller. And it was my getaway money. And we moved here to Santa Fe. And I just sat quietly writing books, which I loved doing. I loved being solitary. I could hardly wait to get up each morning and see what happened next. I'd finished a book tour on my last book, and I started to lay out another book. And I thought, oh, I always wanted to know about sculpture.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave this for another time, which is a whole new chapter of your life, because it's time to go.
No kidding.
An hour has gone by, Ted Flicker. It's been really wonderful having you on the air. Ted Flicker is an actor, writer, director, filmmaker, sculptor, author. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
A pleasure.
The film, The President's Analyst, can be found in Santa Fe at the Video Library, and it can also be rented through Netflix and purchased at Amazon.com. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website, santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team under the marvelous direction of Bill Dupuy. And after that, Good Morning Jazz, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Ciao.